My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God and the program, the people, Principles Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Janice for asking me to come down here and share with you. And I really want to thank Don for picking me up at the airport and took me out to a grassroots everyday meeting today in Huntsville. And I love to do that. That's real AA to me. Richard, I want to congratulate you on your twins. I'm glad that they were twins because after what you said about your wife, I don't think you have an opportunity to have any more. Matter of fact, if I hear a high-piercing shriek in the middle of the night, I'll know you not only don't have the opportunity, you'll no longer have the means to do that anymore. I'd like to welcome anybody here that's new. I'm real glad you're here. I might be more glad you're here than you are. Because I have an idea of what can be in store for you here. And there's a tremendous amount of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous for very, very hopeless people. And I'm real glad you're here. And I hope you can stick around here. And if you can latch on to a good sponsor and work the process that's outlined in the big book in your life and become an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, incredible things will happen to you. Incredible things. I think I was born an alcoholic. I think before I even took a drink, I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic, waiting for alcohol. You know, I remember, I didn't come from an alcoholic family. And that it seems in the last 15, 20 years to become fashionable in AA to you're an alcoholic because your parents were alcoholics. It wasn't my case. I came from a really great family. My parents, I never saw my parents drunk. I don't even really remember even seeing them drink, but I think they might have had a cocktail once or twice somewhere along the lines, but I didn't really pay any attention to that. They loved me. I knew intellectually that they loved me, but there was something about me that I couldn't feel it. And I don't know what that was about, but there's a part in the big book, it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And I think that was true for me from probably the time I was born, because when I look back over at my childhood, really, the only thing I remember is me, basically. I remember me. I remember what I struggled with, what I resented, what I was afraid of. I can't tell you too much about what my parents felt about anything, unless it had to do with me or my sister, but I can remember all about me. And I remember one time I was, my parents used to take me everywhere with them. We were a really tight family, and I was about 3, 4 years old. I was a toddler, and one Sunday afternoon I went with my folks out to this farmer's market. It's where the farmers, it's right outside of town, the farmers bring all their produce in there. And on the way in there, my dad's bragging to my mom about this horseradish that he's going to buy in there. And it's the hottest, spiciest horseradish around. It's won all these awards. And my dad likes stuff like that. And we're going in there, and he's bragging on this stuff. And he went in and got a couple jars, and we were shopping around a little bit. And we left, and on the way home, he's talking to my mom about this horseradish. And I asked him for some. I said, "Papa, can I have some?" And he said to me, "Rob, you can't have any of this. This is only for grown-ups. It's too hot. It's too spicy. You can't have it. You're not old enough, etc." And I'm the kind of kid that I may not really want something until you tell me I can't have it. Then you tell me I can't have it, it's like I gotta have it. To this day, it's almost impossible for me to go walk by a wet paint sign without touching it. I mean, you know what I mean? It's my nature to do that. He says, "Don't touch this wet paint." I gotta touch it. So I waited till my folks weren't around. I went in the refrigerator. I got that jar of horseradish out. Sat on the kitchen floor, had a big spoon. Stuck that in that horseradish, put this in my mouth. This was before LSD, but I think I saw God. I'm not sure. But I got snots pouring out of my nose and tears are running down my eyes. And I spewed horseradish all over that kitchen. I got so sick and so miserable. And that was a lot of years ago, and I have not once sat with a jar of horseradish and a big spoon, didn't have to go to no treatment center, get no sponsor, go to no AMEs, work no steps. But I got to tell you something, that if that horseradish would have made me feel the way that alcohol made me feel, I'd have spent the rest of my life making myself sick with that stuff every chance I could get. Because I think I was born with a hunger and a predisposition to alcoholism. I was born with a piece missing inside of me, and the first time I ever took a drink, it did something for me that I never knew I needed to have done until it was done. And alcohol, when the first time I drank, I was 12 years old, and alcohol made me feel so good and so connected that the way I felt without it was never really okay again. Never really. And I lived to drink. And I was the guy that Dr. Silkworth talks about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. From the first time I ever took a drink, I experienced that phenomenon of craving. But I didn't know that I was under the victim of a phenomenon of craving. I started hitting Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in institutions in 1971. I was just a young kid. And there I'm being placed in these places, and I would hear members of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about this phenomenon of craving, but that's not me, really. I mean, I've seen the movies, The Days of Wine and Roses and The Lost Weekend, and I drink, yeah, and I get drunk, like my friends, but I don't claw the walls to get a drink. I don't have this craving. But the weird thing about a craving is you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. Everybody in this room, including myself, at this very moment, is in the grip of a craving that we're not aware of because it's not interrupted. And that's the craving to breathe air. But if someone were to slip up behind me with a plastic bag and throw it over my head, I'd instantly realize I get this craving to breathe air. And that's why it was so hard for me to identify the craving, because I went to great lengths to protect myself from ever getting in a position where I was cut off. And one of the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous for a guy like me, and the reason that AA works so well for a person like me, is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, no one has ever tried to tell me what I was. Because you really can't. I'm too well defended. And I have certain defense mechanisms that when psychiatrists and psychologists and my folks and probation and parole officers would try to tell me things about me, I might nod my head and go, yeah, yeah, but inside, I'm defending myself. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody tried to do that. You just get up and you talk about yourself. And while you're talking about yourself, I'm not trying to defend myself about being told anything about me. And I just start identifying. And I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the years that I was in and out. And I'm listening to a woman share her experience. And all of a sudden, I remembered something about me that I hadn't thought about in years. And it was one of those rare instances where my drinking was interrupted. And I was about 18 years old. And I was dating a gal, and she invited me over to her house for dinner. She wanted me to meet her folks. It was going to be one of those all-night meet-the-family kind of deals. I hate stuff like that, but I went trying to be a good guy. And we're at this dinner table, and they brought out a bottle of wine. And it wasn't a big bottle of wine. It was just a fifth of wine. And because I don't know what it is about me, I always drank quickly. I don't know. Maybe evaporation is a childhood issue with me or something. I don't know. But I drank quickly, and because I drank quickly, I got two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still sipping on the first glass. Now, I'm 18 years old. I don't know anything about alcoholism. I don't know anything about phenomenon of craving. In my mind, there's absolutely no way I'm an alcoholic, because I was in my long-haired, hippie, better living through chemistry phase of my alcoholism, right? Doesn't make me any less an alcoholic. Alcoholism doesn't care how long your hair is. And I'm sitting at that dinner table. I drink two glasses of wine because I drink quickly. There, I'll finish the bottle. And I'm sitting there, and I'm getting really antsy. And I finally said to him, I said, boy, that was really good wine. Do you have any more? And they said no, and they went back to talking, and I'm sitting there, and now I'm getting real squirrely. You know how you talk to yourself in your head? Well, it's getting a little panicky in there. And I'm just, the chatter is gone, and I'm getting real nuts, and I just want to get out of there, and I don't know what's going on. I finally blurted out, I sure like beer. And they said, well, that's nice, Bob, but we don't have any beer. And they went back to talking about Vietnam and all this other kind of crap, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the night, and I think I'm going to lose my goddamn mind. I don't know what's wrong with me. And I finally excuse myself from the dinner table, and I go to the bathroom, and I lock the door, and like a crazed animal, I go through the cabinets and medicine cabinet in there. I found a bottle of cough medicine. It was 35% alcohol with codeine and turpinhydrate. I sat on the edge of that bathtub. I chugged that bottle of cough medicine. It's like, there's hope. And I developed what it talks about in the 12 concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got singleness of purpose. All the voices in my head became very focused with one idea, let's get out of here. And I went back out to the dinner table, and by this time I can think clearly, and I gave them a story about something I had to take care of, and I was very nice about it, and they said, we're sorry you have to leave. Yes, I'm sorry you have to leave. I went and got in my car, drove like a gentleman, 20, 25 miles an hour, till I made the turn, the end of their street, and then drove like a maniac, 80, 90 miles an hour, to get to a friend of mine's house who had a bar in his basement, because I had two glasses of wine. And it lit something up inside of me that it didn't lighten those other people. Those other people weren't alcoholics. If they'd have been alcoholics, we'd all been in that damn bathroom looking through those cabinets. But alcohol does something to me that it doesn't do to them. And it never will. I know I'm an alcoholic because as an alcoholic, I have never, ever had the experience of sitting in a bar and having the bartender come along and say, Bob, would you like another drink? And I have never had the experience of sitting there and going, no, you know, this is just right. This is just right. No, thank you. I don't need, I've never been there. I have never been just right. Once I start drinking, it sets something off in me that I cannot get enough. I have never been satisfied. I have never been, the only time I get done drinking is when I'm out of money or I passed out. And that was true from the first time I picked up a drink until the last time I picked up a drink. And I, in the road to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of problems. I was in a lot of institutions. I got arrested a lot. I ended up homeless, living on the streets like an animal, all kinds of, everything that happens to a guy like me that doesn't have people to bail them out or some kind of financial props will happen. And that all that stuff happened to me. And I puked a lot. I'm good at it. I was sick not too long ago, and I'm still good at it. And you know, they say that alcoholics, some people try to say alcoholics don't have willpower. I remember one time coming to, and I used to come to sick. And I'd need a drink bad. I mean, real. Like, I used to feel like I was going to jump out of my skin. And I had a little bit of vodka left in this bottle. Just a little bit. And I don't know where I was out doing what I was doing the night before. I don't know what I was doing. But I know that, you know, I got to get this vodka down in order to get well enough to go out there to hustle to get weller. Right? And I've fought this battle a lot of times. But I can't keep nothing down. So I get all psyched up, and I'm going to throw some of this vodka down there, and I am determined I am not going to throw up. I am determined. And I threw that vodka down there, and I clenched my jaw, and it came out my nose. And I must have been in some Skid Row bar the night before eating chili. Because it was just awful. It burned, and I thought I was going to choke to death. And willpower is not. If willpower could conquer alcoholism, I wouldn't be here today. I was a blackout drinker. I had a lot of blackouts. I had a lot of horrible, horrible things happen to me that I didn't remember doing that I had to face when I came to, and I ended up in. I woke up in jail a lot. What? One night, I have a friend, Sean, I think some of you guys know Sean A. from Vancouver. He talks about waking up next to it, right? And we all had that experience, waking up next to it. And he says, you really know it's bad when you wake up one morning and you look at it, and you look in its eyes, and you see that look that lets you know you're its it, right? I heard him say that in a meeting one time, and all of a sudden, there was a memory that I had, and I tried to push down. One morning, I came to, and I don't know where I am, and I'm in some cockroach-infested skid row, one-room hotel room with a bathroom down the hall, and I'm in bed with, I don't know what I'm in bed with, but it's about 600 pounds, whatever it is. It's like this mountain under this, and I'm sick, and I'm cringing, and I'm ashamed of myself anyway, and I remember just sneaking out of there, just like, feeling disgusted, like, what? And my mind is telling me things like, Bob, what did you do last night? You know, and then coming up with all the possibilities, you know. And I'm sneaking down these stairs, and I open this door, and I walk out, and the stairs are between these two storefronts in the broad daylight in the middle of downtown in the city I live in, and all of a sudden I'm in the main middle of a shopping district, and I'm dirty, and my hair isn't combed, and I'm all a mess. And I remember walking away from there and trying to get off that street and just being terrified that somebody might have seen me come out of there, or whoever was up there was going to tell people I was up there. And I had a lot of experiences like that, a lot of experiences. So it's no wonder by the time a guy like me gets to Alcoholics Anonymous is that I don't feel very good about myself. And I live in a lot of fear. And I have a sense that life is going to come at me with stuff at any moment, and I don't know what it's going to be, but it's not going to be good. Because I lived a lot of years where my actions would create things in my life, and then life would come at me with stuff I don't remember doing, and it's a horrible way to live. Horrible way to live. I started hitting Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in 1971. I was put into an institution. I didn't want to go to AA. But I didn't have a choice. And I remember sitting in the back of the room and just feeling awful. And back in Pennsylvania in the early 70s, if you were new, they used to make you stand up. And I hated that. And everybody would look at you. And it's not a time in my life where I want recognition. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't want people to look at me. And I used to feel horrible. And it seemed to me that in Alcoholics Anonymous, the message I heard is I heard these stories about people who drank and did horrible, tragic things. They came to AA, they stopped drinking, found God, and became ecstatically happy. And I'm sitting in the meetings, I haven't drank for a while, and I'm miserable. And I can't tell anybody I'm miserable because I want to fit. And because I want to fit, if somebody talks to me, I try to sound like I'm like you guys, because that's what guys like me do. You know, I'm a chameleon. I'm so terrified at what you'll think of me that I want to be whatever you want me to be. And I get this tremendous sense of separation and this deep-seated knowledge that whatever is wrong with me is not the same thing that's wrong with you. Because I stopped drinking, and I don't feel like you guys are what you're talking about. I mean, it seemed like it to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, everybody who spoke, they loved everybody. Everybody who spoke was more grateful than the person who spoke before them. I mean, and here I am, I'm living in some halfway house because I'm homeless. I hate my life. I hate myself. I'm hanging on by my fingernails. And I'm made to go to these meetings with all these happy, enthusiastic people. I don't like, when you take alcohol out of my life, I don't like to be around people to begin with, and I especially don't like to be around happy, enthusiastic people. I mean, I didn't know what you were. You were like a cross between the Salvation Army and Amway or something. I mean, you're just awful, awful, awful stuff. And I sit in the meetings, and I don't fit, and I see, I get it. If you're new, alcoholics of my type, my alcoholism really starts where the bottle and the bag ends. And what happens to me when I stop drinking is two things. It talks about them in a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The further away I get from my last drink, the more restless, irritable, and discontent I become. What that really means is that I'm restless. I just can't settle anywhere. I never feel like I'm in the right place. I always want to be somewhere else. And I'm irritable. People in life just seem to rub me the wrong way, and I don't know why. And so I end up on the muscle a lot around people and just uptight. And I don't want to be that way. I don't like myself that way, but I don't know how not to be that way. And it causes me a lot of problems. I get sober. I stay sober for a couple months. I get a job, and I can't hold a job because I'm the guy they always call into the office, and they say things to me like, "Well, Bob, you're a hard worker, but there's something wrong with your attitude." Well, what? What's that mean? I mean, I don't get it. Or they'll say things to me like, "You're a hard worker, but you're not a team player." Well, okay. I mean, I'm sober, you're right. I'm not a team player. Give me a pint of Jack Daniels, I'll lead your goddamn team. Sober, you're right. I'm not a team player. Right. Okay. I give you that. But I don't know how to be different. I don't know how to be like those people I work with. I don't know how to be like the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that talk about. God, I hear people, they get great jobs and they keep them for a long time. They have wonderful relationships. And you take alcohol out of my life, and sobriety to me feels like I'm doing time. And eventually I can't stand it. So I get progressively more restless, irritable, and discontent. It's like no matter what happens in my life, I'm not satisfied with it. I think what happens to me, guys like me, is I'll stop drinking and I feel empty and afraid and alone and I feel awful, but I get a case of the when I's. I'm miserable now, but I'll be okay when I get the new job, when I get the raise, when I get the relationship, when I get the school, when I get off probation, when et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens to me is that I spend periods of time in abstinence manipulating my way towards a when I. And then I get it. I get the job I always wanted. Great job. Best job I ever had in my whole life. And after a couple weeks or a couple months working on that job, at an emotional level, subconsciously, I can't stop it. I start to compare what it feels like to have that job to what it felt like to have 5 shots of Jack Daniels. And all of a sudden, I start finding fault with the job. Or I meet that girl and I think to myself, man, with her I'll be happy. With her, being with her would make pigeons fly out my ears. I just know. You know. And what happens is I get with her. And after being with her for several weeks or several months, I start subconsciously comparing what it feels like to be with her to what it felt like to have 5 shots of Jack Daniels. And I start finding things wrong with her. And I feel like she's let me down. Because I'm restless, irritable, and discontent unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort I had once found in taking a few drinks. And I try to find it everywhere I can. And what just happens to me is I just get it up to here with not finding it. And a drink starts coming at me. I start hungering for the effects of alcohol. Because alcohol was the most effective and immediate treatment for alcoholism I've ever found. Magic stuff. I could walk into a bar, just be fed up with life, come off of a job I can't stand, working with people I hate, so uptight I think I'm going to just blow up, have 5 shots of whiskey, 5 beer backs, and watch those guys I work with come into that bar, sit there and just look at them and kind of love them. Just start talking to them, you know, and I planning vacations together, you know, and I just, alcohol relieved me of the bondage of self. Alcohol allowed me to come out and play. Alcohol was a treatment for the disconnection and separation and spiritual sickness of alcoholism. I remember the first time I ever heard that term spiritual malady, spiritual illness. I got really uncomfortable because I'd spent some time in therapy trying to fix myself, and it seemed like a cop-out to me. And it reeked of religiosity. But there's a line in our book, it says, do not let these terms deter you from asking yourself, what do they mean to you? And what it really means to me is when I wasn't drinking, without the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, my spirit would seem to wither and die. My life force would become sick. And 5 shots of whiskey would vitalize my life force. And alcohol at that point in my life was an effective treatment for alcoholism. And I would start, the restless, irritable, and discontent would start to make me hunger for the effects I'd once found in taking a few drinks. And a drink's coming at me. So the further we get away from the last drink, the more restless, irritable, and discontent I become. And at the same time, the further I would get away from that last drink, the vaguer and the hazier the memory of that pain was. And after a while, it's hard to grab on to why I'm putting up with this restless, irritable, and discontent. It's like when I first get sober, if it was a scale, I would have a lot of weight on one side, conviction, because the memory of that pain and that embarrassment and coming to in jail and all that other stuff that happens to guys like me would have a lot of weight. And it would weigh that scale down. On the other side, you'd have a little bit of restless, irritable discontent, a little bit of feelings of separation and loneliness, but not too bad. This is heavier. And as time goes on, the emptiness of my untreated alcoholism becomes more pronounced and heavier, and the memory of that pain becomes vaguer and vaguer. And then all of a sudden, one day, it just seems like a good idea to take a drink. Whereas the day before, you could have put me on a lie detector and asked me if I'd ever drink again. I said, absolutely not. And it would have said I was telling the truth because the scales hadn't quite tipped yet. So I get sober, and I get sober, and I get sober over and over and over and over again. And my life is deteriorating downward more and more and more and more. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I tried a lot of therapy. I had this illusion that even though I came from a nice family and they treated me very well, it seemed to me that somebody must have damaged me somewhere because I felt damaged. I felt like there's something wrong with me and somebody must have done something to me. Maybe my mom said no to the pony or something. I don't know what it was. It scarred me. And I spent a lot of years in therapy with Albert Ellis and one of the contemporaries of Fritz Perls. And I went to a hypnotherapist and I had him regress me back through my childhood thinking that there must be something I haven't uncovered here. And I could never come up with anything. You can't treat a spiritual malady with psychological means because there's never anything there. I was just born with alcoholism. I was born with what I've come to understand and believe is maybe one of God's greatest blessings he ever gives his kids. And I say that because a guy gave me a definition of what a blessing was, and it fits alcoholism pretty good. He said a blessing is anything that pushes you, shoves you, or drags you screaming into being more than what you are. And if that's true, then alcoholism has been my greatest blessing. I would have never... Without the specter of alcoholism and returning to drinking hanging over me, I'd have never made amends to my family. I'd have never learned how to be a good employee and become of service on the job. I would have never learned how to do the things I don't want to do because I ran my life on my feelings. That's what self-absorbed, self-obsessed guys like me do. I mean, I just run my life on how I feel. That's why I ran away from things that were awkward and difficult. If I didn't get there right away, I was gone. I remember in ninth grade, I joined the football team and didn't instantly make first string varsity, so I quit. I wasn't willing to pay the dues like everybody else and hang in there and for the deferred gratification. I wanted it right now because self-absorbed people like me who are just so wrapped up in themselves, we can't stand to wait. And if it wasn't for alcoholism driving me into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have never found the discipline in AA to reconstruct my life. And my alcoholism is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. In your hands. In my hands, I tell you what brought me to AA, and you hear people in AA talk about surrender, and I want to talk a little bit about my surrender. Oddly enough, what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous is not what I would have thought. It was not the homelessness, and was not when I came into AA. I was on the run. I was facing 2 years in prison. I was running from. Wasn't that? It wasn't the fact that I had completely alienated my family, and they would hang up the phone. They would not talk to me. It wasn't the fact that I was totally alone. It wasn't the fact that I had sores and I was sick and physically and I was dying. It was none of that. What brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the only thing that could have brought me here. All that other stuff, I just adjust to that. Silkwer talks about that. He says, after a while, we can't differentiate the true from the false. Our alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. And as I'm riding that progression of the disease down into oblivion, as I get to each lower level, I just adjust to it. And it just becomes part of my life. I remember the first time I ever drank so much that I passed out and wet the bed, how disgusted I was and humiliated and how horrified. Oh, so much shame. 3 years later, I mean, it's just a part of my life. You know, it's just something that happens on a fairly regular basis. I mean, some of us know after a while that if you keep flipping that mattress, after a while you get a kind of an even yellow. I mean, none of that stuff would brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. What brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous is what it talks about in A Vision for You. It says that we get to a place where we can't imagine life with it or without it. We will know a loneliness such as few do. We'll be at the jumping off place and we'll wish for the end. And that's really what brought me here. I would have been willing to pay the dues of alcoholism if I could have still got the effect from drinking that I got when I was 18 years old. I'd have put up with the homelessness. I'd have put up with the time here, the periodic time in institutions. I would have put up with the loneliness. If I could have still got an hour or so every once in a while where I felt connected and lit up and a part of and whole. But I couldn't get that no more. At the end of my drinking, I'm not the guy that's in some Skid Row bar drinking and laughing and shooting pool and talking to the girls and like he's one of the guys. At the end of my drinking, I'm the guy that's sitting over at the end all by himself, drinking himself into oblivion, sometimes sobbing uncontrollably because I feel so awful. Looking out over the bar at the people that are having fun and wondering, what's wrong with me? Because I could remember the glory days. I could remember when alcohol did that for me. And that's all I wanted. That's all I wanted is I just wanted to do that again. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. What I really want, if God would have, 10 minutes before I came into AA the last time, if God would have come down and says, Bob, I'm going to grant you one wish, anything you want, I'd have said, I want that back. That's what I want. I want to be able to drink like I drank when I was 18 years old. But once alcohol stops working and stops being a treatment for alcoholism, for guys like me, I can never get it back. And I almost killed myself trying over and over and over again to grab onto those glory days. And the party was just over. And don't get me wrong, if you're new, it's not that alcohol wouldn't make me drunk and it wouldn't put me in a blackout and give me oblivion. It would do all that. It just no longer relieved me of the bondage of self. It no longer brought me out of myself and allowed me to be connected to other people. And that's what really brought me into AA. I got to a point where I knew a loneliness such as few do. You know, that sick kind of feeling where you're drinking and you're doing the one thing, the only thing I've ever known that allowed me to feel like I fit, and I'm doing it and I still don't fit. And it says we get to the jumping off place and we wish for the end. And I think that that was really the reason I thought about suicide so much the last 2 years. I just felt so hopeless and so stuck. Life was unbearable drunk, and it was unbearable sober. Sobriety was terrible. Drunkenness was terrible. I love W.C. Fields. He says, I was sober one time. It was the most boring 45 minutes of my life. I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't live without it. And I kept ending up in the A&A. over. And I don't even know if I'm an alcoholic, really. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm a special kind of alcoholic. I'm not like you people, because there's got to be something else wrong with me, because I stopped drinking and I ain't like you. And what had never occurred to me is that I stopped drinking and I was standing in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, dying of untreated alcoholism, comparing how I felt with untreated alcoholism, which is really what kills guys like me, to what you look like with a program of recovery in your life. And I was coming up short. Because I never did what you did, I couldn't possibly feel like you feel. I thought I was part of AA. I wasn't part of AA. I was part of the passing parade that goes through Alcoholics Anonymous on its way to the graveyard. I was one of the group that it talks about in the beginning of chapter 5 when it says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. And I've been to AA, all right, went to some meetings, took a stab at prayer here once in a while, took a stab at talking to somebody, getting it transparent, but I didn't buy the whole package. I've even in institutions did the rehab versions of the steps that have nothing to do with AA. I mean, they're so far from Alcoholics Anonymous as thinking that I'm doing AA. I was sharing this with Chuck earlier, and I don't know if I've ever talked about this in the podium. I have a friend down in Southern California named Donna, and I heard her talk not too long ago, and she said something that was so moving to me. She had a son who came into Alcoholics Anonymous at about 6 or 7 months of sobriety, committed suicide. And she had to go over to her son's apartment and clean his stuff up. And in the apartment, she found a notebook. And in the notebook was a page of directions that was given to her son by his sponsor. And it was a whole list of things like drink lots of water, exercise, don't get emotionally involved, go to work, open a bank account, take vitamins, go to your aftercare groups, attend AA meetings. Nice sounding stuff. And she read that list from the podium and she said something that really touched me. She said that it was all seemingly good stuff, but none of it was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that had been offered to her when she came to AA. And what a tragic thing that is. That someone could come to AA, sit in these rooms as I sat there, dying of untreated alcoholism, and eventually take their own life because they think they tried AA and they never tried AA. And I almost died of alcoholism thinking I did Alcoholics Anonymous and I never did AA. All the stuff I did in those rehabs was just imitations. It was nothing. It was the fourth step that I did in several different institutions doesn't even, it's like 180 degrees from what it talks about in the big book. When I finally came into Alcoholics Anonymous and did the fourth step out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it changed my life. There's a very simple little thing in that process on resentment that gave me that 180 degree turn. When it says in there, this was our course. We had to realize how the person who had harmed us was perhaps like us, spiritually sick. That part of the book has changed my life. In my 11th year of sobriety, if it wouldn't have been for the force going back and doing another fourth step, as it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be a dead man. You'd have a different speaker tonight. I went through my 11th year of sobriety. I got a resentment I could not shake. I could talk about it until I was blue in the face. I wouldn't go away. I'd been married in AA to a gal for several years, and we kind of grew apart a little bit. And she wanted out of the marriage, and I didn't want out. I said, let's try some marriage counseling. And she said, okay, we'll try some marriage counseling. We did that for a while. My original sponsor was out of town. He was back on the East Coast traveling around for a couple months in an RV. So my confidant became one of the guys I sponsor, who was my best friend. And my wife comes to me one day, she says, I don't want to go to the marriage counseling anymore, I'm done. And so we got a divorce, and in Vegas you get a divorce quick if you don't contest it. We're divorced on a Thursday. The next day, Friday, my wife and my daughter move in with my best friend, the guy that I sponsored, that was my confidant with my marriage problems. Now, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and talking to people about this stuff, and I started hearing a lot of crazy stuff. I heard people say things to me like, well, just don't think about it. I had one guy say, well, if you really believe in God, what's the problem? Well, my God loves me very, very much, and he takes really good care of me. He threw waves of newcomers at me that were going through marriage breakups and relationships. I mean, I thought at one point I had like four or five of them in my car. We'd drive to meetings together. We'd be like the depressed section of the meeting. You know? I mean, there's nobody on the face of the earth more self-obsessed than an alcoholic coming out of a relationship. You can go up to a guy like that and say, I just came from the doctor, I got cancer, I got 3 weeks to live. And he'll say, you know what else she said, man? She, I mean, you know, that's true. But God put that stuff, those people in my life until I could come back and do this process. And I tell you, this process did more for me than 20 years of therapy couldn't have done what that fourth step did for me with that marriage. Because I had to look at what was threatened, hurt, affected, or interfered with. And then I had to do the hardest thing a guy like me ever has to do. I have to get honest enough with myself to put myself in their shoes. Didn't want to do it. Because when I stood in my wife's shoes, I saw what it was like to be married to me. I saw what it was like to be a woman who came from an alcoholic home, who could not face confrontation, who hitched her wagon to a guy who worked 70 hours a week trying to build this business. It's all his idea. It's so involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, all the other waking hours are involved. He's doing that. I found myself standing in the shoes of a woman who must have lived in a tremendous amount of loneliness and desolation, who was married to a guy that really wasn't there very much. There's a line in the family afterwards that says, we become emotionally inaccessible. And it, you know, I could say that I have all the rationale why I did that, all the rationale why I was building this great financial security, and I had to do the AA. And there's some validity in all of that, except the real truth is that those were all real convenient situations in my life, because I don't know how to do intimacy very well. Because after we get past the first several months, I run out of things to say. And I don't know how to do it anymore. So it's real easy for me to stay busy. Which might have been all right if I was married to someone who was very independent. But I wasn't. And I started to get a sense of her desolation and loneliness. And I thought to myself, my God, if I was in her shoes, I probably would have had that affair a year before she did. How did she go that long? And I started to become free. I just had an experience with that fourth step not too long ago with a guy that blew my mind. This guy had come from an alcoholic family. His father would beat him unmercifully as a child, degrade him. He'd come home drunk and just whoop those kids. And he had a resentment that was over 30 years old. He'd spent years in therapy trying to become free of that. This resentment had dominated his whole life. And we're doing the fifth step. And we get up to that part, this was our course, and we start talking about it. And he really gets on the muscle with me. And he's raising his voice, and he starts almost yelling at me, I'm not like my goddamn dad. You're trying to say I'm like my dad. I ain't like my dad. I'd never done that. He went on and on and on and on. And I let him go. When he's done, I said to him, don't you have a couple kids from a past marriage? And he got real weird look on his face. He says, yeah, what of it? I said, when you're drunk, did you ever do anything to hurt those kids? And he looked at me, and he got this weird look, and he started to cry. And he says, my God, I'm just like my father. I said, how did you feel about yourself after you beat those kids? He says, I couldn't stand myself. I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, you think your dad's any different? He said, my dad was never able to get sober. He's old now, and his liver's going. He can't drink, but he could never stop, and he's miserable. I said, could you see how that could be you? And he says, my God, my poor father. And he started to making amends to his father, and he was able to go and be. His father just died not too long ago. And he was able to be there with his father until he died. 30 years of therapy could not change that guy. This is a very powerful, powerful process in this book. And yet we take it for granted sometimes. I belong to a home group that's real involved in service in AA, and I started doing on 12-step calls when I was brand new. I told my sponsor, my original sponsor, I said, I don't really feel like I have anything to give away. And he says, if you wait till you feel like you're ready to go on a 12-step call before you go on one, you'll die of alcoholism before, because you'll never feel like you're ready. You just do this stuff. And I started getting pushed into doing some things that were really against my feelings. And I think that there's a line that goes right through Alcoholics Anonymous that a guy like me eventually has to cross in order to stay here. And that line is, once I cross it, I become the kind of person that what I do here is more important than how I feel. And I had never was that way. I was always, how I felt was what ran my life. If somebody asked me to do something and it was difficult, awkward, inconvenient, painful, or costly, I could find a way to sidestep it. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, they started telling me to do some things I didn't want to do. And I started doing. I had it. My original sponsor was merciless when it came to amends. Just merciless. Other people in AA could get away with stuff. He would not let me get away with nothing. I remember I had to go to my dad when I was sober. The first time I ever saw my mom and dad, I was about a year sober. They finally came out to Las Vegas. They'd never seen Vegas, and they wanted to kind of look to see if I was... They couldn't believe I was sober a year. I mean, they could not believe it. And I had my list, my amends deal with them on a piece of paper, and I went and I had lunch with them in the Stardust Hotel one day, in the coffee shop. And I start telling my mom and dad about, this is what I owe you, this is what I figured out. If this isn't right, I want you to let me know. This is the best of my ability, all the money I borrowed from you, everything. And I want to start paying you so much a month, and here's the first payment, and et cetera, et cetera. And I never forget this. My mom and dad looked at each other, and my dad grabbed my mom's hand and kind of squeezed it, and they smiled at each other. He turned to me, and he says, Rob, we don't want your money. We're just so happy you're sober. Just keep doing what you're doing, and that's all we ever wanted for you. And, man, I was elated. I thought, man, this ninth step stuff is good stuff. I mean, I just saved lots. I saved like a year's salary, you know. I mean, this is great stuff. And I'm going on my way to my sponsor's office. On the way to tell him the good news, I'm thinking to myself about some of the other people I owe money to. You know, if I told him about the meeting I secretaried, how they might see the light too, you know, and I get over there, I tell my sponsor about what my dad said, and my sponsor says, I don't care what your dad said, it's not his debt, it's yours, you've got to find a way to pay him. Boy, if there's ever a time I wanted to change sponsors, I'll tell you. So I had to find a way to pay my dad back. And it was a long or involved process. It took me almost 5 years. Oddly enough, by the time I paid my father back, 6 months after I paid him back, he died. And I was able to go to his funeral and bury him, and there was no unfinished business. There was no unfinished business. Everything had been said. He knew that I loved him. He knew that I knew that he loved me. I owed him nothing. We were even. What a tremendous thing Alcoholics Anonymous does for guys like me who lived in a world that I was always so separate and apart from, and I never felt like I fit. I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to die. On my last drunk, I really was trying to commit suicide. I was standing on this bridge with a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And I'm looking down on these railroad tracks about 50 feet, no, about 100 feet below, and I'm sobbing uncontrollably, trying to get up enough courage to jump off this bridge and do what it seemed very clear to me was the right thing to do, just to get it over with, to get it over with. And I couldn't come up with the courage to do it, because it might hurt. I mean, I might screw this up like I've screwed up everything else in my life and end up in a hospital charity ward somewhere, paralyzed from the neck down, while members of Alcoholics Anonymous bring their newcomers in, and you hear them say things like, "This is what happens to you if you don't work our glorious 12 steps." You know, I can't even give them the salute. You know, I'm just stuck there. You know? I'm just stuck there listening to my head tell me what a piece of crap I am for the next 40 years. I can't even touch my privates. I'm just stuck there like this. I couldn't live, I couldn't die, I was stuck, man. And, you know, when I was, I'm jumping so much around. When I was new in sobriety, you know, I came off the streets, I was homeless, and I did not have the ability to ask people for help. I could ask my sponsor a little bit. And people and alcoholics, I'll tell you something, there are some incredible lovers in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are some people here who know how to love the unlovable. And I had guys come up to me, and I remember one time this guy came up to me after a meeting, and he says, "I really need your help." He said, "My wife is on my case. She wants me to get rid of all these clothes, and if I don't get them out of the house, I don't think I can go home." And he says, "If you would take them off my hands, you would really be helping me a lot." And went out to the trunk of his car, and they were all pressed and folded and ironed and cleaned, and they were all my size. And his wife didn't tell him that. He just knew that if he tried to give me that, my pride wouldn't let me take it. That I would have said, "No, thank you, I don't need it. I'm just that kind of guy." Because I felt so ashamed of myself and so awful about me that I could not deserve any kind of help or anything. And guys would give me rides to meetings, and they'd buy me lunch sometimes, and I'd say things to them, you know, like, "Oh, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to pay you back," and they'd always say the same thing to me. They'd say, "No," he said, "this is Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't pay me back. Don't insult me like that. What you have to do is you got to make the commitment to stay sober long enough to do the same thing for somebody else." And I was able to maintain a little bit of my integrity when inside myself I would say to myself, "Yes, I will do that," and I have. And I continue to do that. I was over in Japan 8 or 9 years ago for Alcoholics Anonymous convention. I got to talking to this guy, this Japanese guy, and he told me something that I thought was very interesting. He said that there was, in the Japanese language, there was many different phrases that they use to express gratitude when one person helps another. And he said that every one of those expressions of thanks translates out as a different form of resentment. Because when you help me, you've diminished me, I've lost face, because I shouldn't be in that spot to begin with. I should be able to do that for myself. And alcoholic, and I think I started thinking about that, and I thought that's a very human thing. Every time anybody ever tried to help me, I always felt bad about it. I always felt shamed. I always felt uncomfortable. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we circumvent that whole process by making an obligation, not to any individual, but to whoever God would put in my path in the future to help when I find myself in a position to do that. My home group does a lot of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. We do right today, I think we're doing 11 hospital and institution meetings every week. I have three of those that are committed meetings for me: Monday night, Tuesday afternoon, Thursday afternoon. If you're ever in Las Vegas, it'd be my pleasure to take you to one of those meetings. I also do a step workshop in my house. I've been doing it since 1987. It's every Tuesday night. We start out with about 70 guys. We get down to four step. We're down to about 40, 30. because it's not a step study. We actually do it. And when the people realize, "Oh, we actually got to write this," I mean, it just thins out a lot of people. But it's one of those commitments that in Alcoholics Anonymous are some of the greatest things I've ever had to do in my life. This Skid Row detox, I'm going to tell you about for a minute about this Skid Row detox I go to. I go there twice a week. And it's the only place in Southern Nevada that will take you if you have no money or no insurance. So this is like low bottom. They're the only place that the police department will pick people that if they've had to get out of the weeds and they bring them over there. And I take a meeting down there twice a week. And I started to see, and I've been doing this for years and years, and I see something in those meetings that most people in Alcoholics Anonymous never see. I see the people that were sober 15, 20, 25, 30 years that drink again. And the reason most people don't see that in Alcoholics Anonymous is that those people never make it back to mainstream AA. They die going in and out of institutions. They die in St. Vincent's and the Salvation Army in the Skid Row detox after many, many times going back. And I have made it a study to talk to these people and find out what they've been doing in their life. What's been going on with them? What's been happening? What was their program about? And I'm one who believes that if I have the same disease that they have, what can happen to them can happen to me. If I walk down the road they walk down, I will get the scenery they got. And it's not that I would like to believe that I'm bulletproof or this is me, I would never do that. That's crap. I've seen this too many times. I've seen guys that had incredible programs of recovery. And I've come to understand that what kills them is the second delusion it talks about in the big book. In chapter 3, there's two delusions it talks about, and there's a third one in chapter 5. And the second delusion it talks about says the delusion that we are like other people. You know, like non-alcoholic people. People who don't need a sponsor. People who don't need to work with newcomers on a regular basis. People who don't need to maintain a relationship with God and go to AA meetings. The delusion that we are like other people, or that we presently may be like other people, has to be smashed. Presently maybe, like maybe 20 years. I mean, you'd think, if I went to a meeting every day for 20 years, I could stop going. Or if I worked with newcomers, if I worked with 20 newcomers last year, isn't that good enough for this year? And I don't know what it is about it. What I see in these people, and I listen to the same story, and I've heard this story 1,000 times. So a guy comes into Alcoholics Anonymous, he's whooped. He gets real involved in AA, gets a sponsor, talks to his sponsor on a regular basis, goes to meetings, goes to 8, 5, 6, whatever meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week, gets involved in service, starts sponsoring people, going on 12-step calls, making amends, doing daily inventories. And then at 4 or 5 years of sobriety, he's going to a couple less meetings, a little bit less activity in AA, a little bit less sponsorship, a little bit less 12-step work. And then at 10 years of sobriety, he's going to quite a few less meetings, quite a few less less service in AA, a little less activity with his sponsor. And his feet start to depict someone who secretly thinks that as time goes on, they have less alcoholism than they had in prior years. Now you ask one of those persons, now I just went through this with a guy who's sober about 15 years and he's backing away from Alcoholics Anonymous. He's literally judging his way right out. He's taking everybody else's inventory. He's in less and less involvement. And I said to him, I said, don't you think you're an alcoholic? He says, absolutely, I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic. Well, why don't you act like it? Well, I think to myself, I'm not going to drink every day, and I talk to some people in AA. He can't see that his feet are walking the walk from alcoholism into alcoholism. His feet are saying, I don't really need alcohol. I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous like I needed it when I was 3 years sober or 5 years sober. And then I see those guys, they end up in detox. And there's something about Las Vegas, it's a wonderful place to live if you're real involved in AA, because it's like the hitting bottom capital of the world. If you're sober in Alabama or Iowa or Connecticut or Canada or Hawaii and you're sober 15, 20, 25 years and you drink again, Las Vegas is like a magnet. I mean, it's just like, these guys end up on the streets between the gambling and the alcohol and the cocaine and the prostitutes. They end up there destitute, nothing left, homeless. And we're talking about people that a year before had a $500,000 home, a wife, a family, a job. And I get to see them on a regular basis in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it does something for me that I can find nowhere else. See that? There's in the book, it talks about the further I get away from the last drink, I get to a point where I have a seeming inability to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'm without defense against the first drink. I cannot sit in my big home up on the hill with all my friends that are sober a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous and really bring into my consciousness with sufficient force what it was like to come off a drunk. What it was like to be in a place where I hated myself so much I wished I had the courage to kill myself. But if I get down in those trenches on a regular basis and I hang out with those people and I give them rides to meetings and I sit and I talk with them and I help them go through the steps, it is constantly in my face. And I get renewed on a regular basis to what I am. And I stand here and I am an alcoholic. I have a disease called alcoholism and I need help. Today. I'm going to tell you a little story and then I'm going to quit. I've been ending with this for years and it's the story of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a guy, Sunday afternoon, he's got the day off and he's sitting in his easy chair and he's just hanging out, reading the newspaper, relaxed. He's got a six-year-old daughter and she comes running up and says, "Daddy, please play with me." He says, "Not now, sweetheart. I'm busy. I'm reading the paper." He says, "Daddy, please play with me." And he looks in the paper, and there's an ad in there for an airlines. And it's a full-page map of the world that shows where the planes go. And he gets an idea. He tears it out of the newspaper. He tears it up into little pieces. He grabs a roll of scotch tape, and he says, "Sweetheart, here's a puzzle. Take it in your room. It's a map of the world. Tape it together, and if you bring it back, I'll play with you for the rest of the day." He figures he's off the hook. She's 6 years old. She didn't have a shot. 10 minutes later, she brings it back, and it's taped together perfectly. And he goes, "My God, sweetheart, how did you do that?" And she said, "It was easy, Daddy. On the back was a picture of a man, and when I put the man together, the world just kind of fell into place." And if you're new, I encourage you with everything from everything in me that if you sit here and you're not drinking and you feel a sense of separation and you don't seem to fit in this world the way other people seem to fit in here, grab a sponsor, work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, give away everything that you find here, and you will walk into the most incredible experience you've ever imagined, a world that seemed so alien and hostile and distant and separate from you will become the most incredible place you've ever imagined. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. I've always said that probably the most important thing I saw that AA gave you was your dignity back, and I think what you reminded me of tonight was you can lose it again if you're not careful. Thank you for the message. For those that care to, let's stand again and hold hands and close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer.
Trespass against us.